I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imitation, the sincerest form of flattery. It is VGC, a video game podcast with me, Pete Donaldson, Andy Robinson, and Christopher Dring. This week, we've got meshes with alarming similarities. We've got more layoffs, and the Switch 2 projects are gathering apace. But first, how are we doing, folks? Andy, what's going on in your world?
I'm just arguing about Pokemon on Twitter this week.
Okay. That's... Why are you with Jordan away? Where's Jordan? Is he in America?
Well, I've got to pick up the slack. He's at Respawn. Apex Legends guys. I'm guessing I can say that because he slapped it all over social media.
Yeah.
don't ask me what he's doing. Even I don't know.
No. So, Andy, what's been the main kind of bane? Are you kind of getting in the weeds with which Pokemon are your favourite? Which ones aren't
no,
your favourite?
Definitely not.
You have very dim views on these little Pokemon.
It's just the usual fraud accusations, with people with avatars of certain platforms.
Yeah. Andy, do you ever sort of think when you're arguing with these people that you sort of the general sort of gaming populace don't have that much of a handle on the legalities of the video games that they love and also just general IP? They don't really have a handle on how the world works and how legal writs kind of happen.
It does cross my mind when I'm arguing with Xbox Dude 72XXX on our Twitter with two followers. Yeah, it does cross my mind that he might not have a full grasp on
the
reality, the intricate details of every situation.
Yeah. Chris, have you ever found yourself embroiled in an IP battle? Have you ever created a logo that's just a little bit too similar to another?
Actually, I do have a story here. About during the pandemic, I was doing a video games event about how well the market's doing, and I had a.
All of your industry friends went there, and it was called Power World.
No, it was called State of Play. The name of
right.
my event.
Let me guess, who had an issue with that?
Well, I mean, it was very friendly. They went, "Can you not call it that?" And I went, yeah.
What did you rename it to? Nintendo
but
Direct?
I want to.
I named it State of Games. That was my brush with the law.
And I think sometimes like people think that if you do this sort of thing, they will put these writs on you and you will be sued to within an inch of your life and you'll lose all of your money. But 9 times out of 10, it is just, can you stop doing that? And you stop doing that. And then whatever money you've invested in getting this far down the line, you just have to pee up a wall to a certain extent.
You just change the thing.
All right, it's a fair cop, Gov. And then you keep on going. Because
state
legal...
of game.
State of stuff. Just pints and lads having a good chit-chat. Let's kick into the first news story. Let's get in nice and quick. Palworld, a new video game that everyone's been getting very excited about. The director of the breakout hit Palworld has responded to allegations of plagiarism as accusations mount that the game could have copied some of Pokemon's designs. Since launching into early access on the PC and Xbox on Friday, Palworld has become a juggernaut. Over 5 million sales and more than 1.3 million concurrent Steam players.
I think
players.
It's 7 million sales now.
7 million now. We blinked and it increased. But there has been a lot of chat about some perceived similarities between the character designs of the characters in the video game and those of the Pokemon titles. It's It's been well talked about over the weekend, and I do have a little bit of a grounding on 3D, certainly low polygon design from what I wanted to do when I left university, because I did train in like 3D studio a little bit, and even I can sort of look at some of these and sort of go, it's very hard if you're not like just control C, control V-ing, and then you know moving some things around. It is quite hard to make almost identical dimensions of animals from one game to another. Andy, your feelings on this? Have you seen the images? Have you seen the documents?
Well, yeah, I've been covering this. I think VGC has been pretty near the front on covering this situation, which means that we get all of the abuse brilliantly.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't think anyone who has, you know, knows what a Pokemon is can look at this game and not see the obvious similarity. It's very clearly heavily influenced by Pokemon, right? I mean, you can play this game and go, oh, that's this Pokemon and that's that Pokemon. You know, they're very clearly kind of mashing different Pokemon monsters together. I don't think there's much debate on that one. But the issue is whether it actually counts as plagiarism, right? Because you're allowed, you can't sue someone for taking inspiration, no matter how brazenly they have done. That's not something that you can stop. Otherwise, you know, as an IP lawyer told me this week, you wouldn't really have many Git video games because even though
everything's
not many fly as close to the sun as this one has, obviously everyone takes inspiration off of everything. I mean, the issue here is, as you just mentioned, is that one guy on Twitter took it a step further this week, and he extracted the models of some of the particularly
egregious
suspicious
examples.
Yes, exactly. It was about a half dozen of these POW models, and compared them to their Pokemon models from Scarlet and Violet. Mm. And they're very, very, very similar, right? They're not the same, but they're very, very similar. Like, proportion-wise, they kind of like, they overlap
It would take a lot of time to get them exact, almost to the point that why would you bother in the first place? Which puts into, again, we're not saying anything. I'm just saying it would be very difficult to match it, the dimensions almost exactly.
Well, I mean, if I don't understand. I'm not a professional 3D modeler, right? Believe it or not. So
amateur 3D modeler.
So obviously, the first thing I do is as a journalist is go and ask some 3D modelers. And I spoke to two guys who work at big AAA studios, who do this for a living. And they were like pretty convinced. I think the quote from one was, you cannot in any way accidentally get the same proportions on multiple models from another game without ripping the models, or at the very least tracing them meticulously first. And they ended with, I would stand in court to testify this as an expert. Yeah. So you can't get more damning than that. They gave some examples as well about how they do tests when they're hiring artists at their studio. And they have 30 artists like make a horse based on the same schematics, and none of them overlap, you know, like these do. So certainly the professionals I've spoken to are pretty convinced that they have traced these over Pokemon. There's some more like damning evidence. I mean, you can imagine like the internet sleuths are like digging through this stuff. There's one particular POW. I don't know what its name is. Is it Serperior?
Right, okay.
And there's a Pokemon called Prime Marina. So I'm not a massive Pokemon guy anymore. So the most damning thing about this that's been noted is that there are parts of the models like massively overlap, but they overlap from the model as it is in like the blender, the work environment.
Yes.
So imagine like this particular Pokemon has hair that when it's not in the game and it hasn't got physics applied to it and animations applied to it, the hair is like completely straight. It sticks up. And the POW model matches that. So in other words, it would only match if they'd have extracted the model.
Yes.
Like, because the in-game one doesn't look anything like that. So there's all sorts of stuff like that. I think is pretty convincing, but I don't think it's really...
No,
I don't think
and you don't want to go on record saying that. And Chris, obviously the situation is further muddled by the fact that Pocket Pair, the company that produced this video game, has historically used generative AI tools, quite boldly in their titles. Artist Zetri noted on X that one of its previous titles was literally AI Art Imposter, which literally utilizes an AI image generator as its core mechanic. And in this kind of new world of taking and remixing and duetting, I suppose, with original artistry and creations. Is this all rather unedifying? Is this where the industry is going?
AI. I don't know if it'll go quite. I mean, let's be clear. I think it, obviously when they use AI, they put it in the title of their game, right? They're quite upfront about it. I think. But we are living in an industry right now that's where it's not making as much money as it was, it's got huge. It's recently invested huge amounts of money in expanding its teams and become a much, much, much bigger industry. Video game costs are spiraling upwards, and game developers are looking at ways to be able to make games faster and more cheaply. And AI can afford that. Now, whether that means, like, I don't think that's going to result in them using AI to design their games. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, well, actually I know they'll start using AI in other ways in order to speed up processes and be able to put stuff out faster and update things quicker, which is, you know, is what I think we'll start to see. And we are starting to see it, I think. You know, Andy's wearing a Foam Stars t-shirt with the but it's
have you printed that yourself? It's very simple.
I made it with generative AI.
His garage.
So yeah, it's sort of heading in that direction. Here's the thing with that game, Pocket Pair. I think they're a really tiny development studio, right? They used all the money they made from their previous game in funding this one. So it's only $7 million spent on it. Most of the team are contractors. I suspect from countries where you can get quite cheap contractors, creep art contractors, in Indonesia, Malaysia, those sort of places. And I wouldn't be, you know, and that does create a risk, a quality risk. You don't know who these people necessarily know them as well, and they don't necessarily follow your procedures as thoroughly. It's difficult. So, you know, if there is any tracing or sort of borrowing or anything going on, it's quite possible. And it's worth noting that games companies do this. They've done this historically, even big ones, right? And sometimes they do it and they don't realize they've done something wrong. Like, how many games feature a TARDIS, not really realizing it's a BBC?
Yeah, I mean, the point there, the important point is that not every game sells 7 million copies in five days. So that's why this is a thing.
Yeah, and GoldenEye stole all the art assets from a book. So is it in it for the Egyptian level, for instance? Point being is it these things
aren't good. Textures from books and stuff have been historically. Remember, was it Doom or Quake had or maybe Half-Life had a real human corpse's face, like a burned corpse in, I think, the original Half-Life used a really, really old texture from some kind of medical book, I think. And so this dead dude just ended up in Half-Life as a burned corpse.
Resident Evil 4 and Devil May Cry were involved in a lawsuit, I think, a couple of years ago as well, because it was someone who owns an asset CD found out that they'd taken textures from that as well. But again, that's a completely different conversation, taking textures for reference of something that's real.
And not paying a license for them.
Versus knocking off a design of I think it's... You can't really call them a competitor because they're completely different games,
but different platforms. Here's the thing. Like, I'm sure that, you know. And here's the thing: they'll want Power World at some point on Switch or Switch 2, right? That'll be a goal for them. And Nintendo will probably want the game on there. You know, they've always been quite fond of games that might appeal to its audience on their platform. And I'm sure if they want to do that, they might want to move away from some of the more obvious things, and I'm sure there'll be, maybe there's a cease and desist coming, maybe there isn't, maybe they'll update those models anyway.
My understanding is that they're not, I don't think they're doing anything, the Pokemon company. My understanding is that they don't have the smoking gun, they're not going to do anything, and I wouldn't be surprised if we actually saw it come to Nintendo platform in the future. But I mean, really, to summarize, there's two conversations here, which is, obviously, has it plagiarized Pokemon, and can anyone do anything about it? And I think the answer to the first one is absolutely yes. I mean, I think I've been very disappointed, to be honest, to see certain, you know, kind of corners this week dismiss this as internet drama when this is quite blatant blatant, plagiarism happening here. Mm. It doesn't matter whether they're $1 billion company or a $1 million company. It's not in the world where AI is creeping in and there's pressure to, reduce your workforce. I don't think it's something we should be dismissing in what it could become a very slippery slope. These developers' previous games are all other very clear knockoffs. If you've not seen them, go and have a look. There's one that is Breath of the Wild. I mean, visually they are anyway. Mm. Breath of the Wild is knocks off in one of them quite clearly. There's another one that looks like Hollow Knight. Mm. The CEO is on Twitter shouting from the hills about how much he loves stealing ideas. Genuinely, you go through his Twitter account, is lots of comments about how he dropped out of Nintendo graduate course because he doesn't agree with their philosophy of creating new ideas. He's created by AI as a villain, right? He published a article about the development of this game last week where he said the majority of the 100 PAL designs in the game were made by one graduate student he hired from a convenience store.
Right.
They had no animation or art experience before this game. Their previous game was with assets purchased off of marketplaces. They didn't know what rigging was. Well, there's a whole passage how they realized it would take a month per character to create and it would take them 10 years to do it. And they don't really resolve how they solve that situation. So I don't think there's much debate at all about whether they've copied these designs. The second point is, what can anyone do about it? And I spoke to, a couple of lawyers this week, including an IP lawyer. And the gist of it is that if Nintendo wanted to, Pokemon Company even wanted to, pursue this, and that's if, because to Chris's point as well, this is now like the biggest game for years, if not one of the biggest game ever on Steam, it could end up being. Do you really want to like go and create that mess when you could just put it on your platform, especially with it being another Japanese company as well? That makes it a bit easier, I imagine, for them to resolve, to have that dialogue. But even if they did, they would need... It's a high bar for that sort of, this is what the IP lawyer told me, it's a high bar for that sort of plagiarism case where you have to have clear evidence of copying. Mm. Not that looks a bit like that, that's clear, that it has to be very clear evidence of copying. And I don't think the Pokemon Company are going to pursue that. I imagine you're about to mention the statement they put out.
Well, I mean, you would sort of think, especially because, Nintendo have said they intend to investigate and take appropriate measures to address any acts that infringe on intellectual property rights related to the Pokemon. We will continue to cherish and nurture each and every Pokemon and its world and work to bring the world together through Pokemon in the future. I mean, let's forget about the weird end to that particular statement. But you sort of think that this company... with Palworld, they've made a boatload of money in about a week. Could they not just sort of go, right, here's 250 grand and let's just change all of the characters, pre-rigging. Let's just randomize the characters.
I think it might have to be a bit more money than that, where they've sold 7 million copies in 5 days. But
well, I mean, they've only got 100 characters to change, haven't they? So, I mean, you could just get a squad of five.
You could just get one graduate
people.
Student.
Just get one graduate
store.
Student, yeah. An infinite number of graduate students and an infinite number of copies of Blender.
And I think it's a shame, really, as well. I imagine they would probably do it all over again because clearly the controversy and the similarity to Pokemon's helped them.
Yeah.
However, the actual game's nothing like Pokemon. It's a survival game. It's like Minecraft. It's nothing like Pokemon. So it is a shame that, in a sense, that it's distracting from that, because if this game had like wholly original looking designs, I think it'd be getting a lot more good press than it is.
Mm. It's one of those things, though, isn't it? You get this in book. It's interesting because while we're talking about this, I've been doing a lot of event talking a lot recently about the future of games, future of entertainment generally, and about how we're putting games you're putting things in the arms of fans to go and make their own stuff. So they're remixing. The people are taking Lord of the Rings and writing their own version of it, and then they're mixing the genres in. They're turning it into a detective novel and all this kind of stuff. And there's an element of that's what's gone on here, right? They've taken Pokemon, they've taken Breath of the Wild, they've taken Ark Survival Evolved, and they've taken a base building thing, and they've just gone, right, Fortnite, basically gone. And then it's is lacking in the all of those component parts lack originality, but by sticking them together, they've created something different, but sort of not. And it's caught on and it's excited people. And actually, in an industry right now where things are quite bleak, from a business point of view, I'm actually quite excited to see the game do well.
I think you're gonna see more of these types of games, right? I think developers and the media like to believe that this is not the case, but this is proof that a large proportion of players don't care about originality and they just want familiarity. And I know this and I know that, and it's mashed together. There's a reason why every game for the last 15 years has had the same control scheme, right? Do you remember the days when you needed to read the controls? What are the controls? Since Call of Duty Modern Warfare standardized FPS controls, you don't look at the controller, right? You click the stick in and it ducks, or one of them runs and one of them X reloads and Y changes your weapon. And, you know, the trigger, they're all the same controls because no one would dare try anything new now because players like familiarity.
Mm. But I mean, Chris, a lot of this, a lot of debate around Pal World is obviously kind of tying in AI. It's not strictly an AI conversation, but obviously the CEO has produced games before who have used a lot of AI generative tools. But there have been kind of pieces coming out recently, and this week, in fact, nearly 50% of developers say generative AI tools are being used at their workplace. 84% say that they're concerned about their use. There's obviously a big GDC State of the Game industry survey, which asked more than 3,000 developers across indie and AAA studios about their work and the industry. And they basically asked whether stuff like ChatGPT, DALL-E, Copilot, Adobe Photoshop integration for their generative fill were being used at their company. 31% of respondents said they've used such tools. A further 18% said they didn't, but others in their workplace did. And this kind of ties in with how expensive it is to make video games. Like you said, indie studios are more likely to use these tools at the moment. 37% of respondents from those studios say that they personally used it. And in your job, Chris, obviously very data heavy, your role with your company, you kick around an unholy amount of data. Have you found these tools of any use, or because they're quite new, are you kind of second guessing the results they give?
Well, generative AI tools.
I mean, at the end of the day, from my perspective, I've used ChatGPT as just a fancy Google, effectively. So, for you, presumably, these sort of things could actually be quite helpful to create systems and processes.
Yes, I guess in a way, a lot of people use these tools to speak for speed, not necessarily money. Like, I was at a few conferences recently where people have been presenting games to investors, right? And they need to create mock-ups of what their game's going to look like, and they haven't had time to do it all. So they've stuck it into Midjourney, whatever it is, to get these things made up. So they're using it, but not in a sort of public-facing way. They're using it in a sort of speeding way, or they're using it for inspiration. You know, it's the thing that I sort of toyed around with seeing how good it might be at creating a release schedule and things like that in the past. Mm. But it's just I've never actually used it for anything work-wise, just seeing how it worked. And not I'd say, you know, using it for a bit of inspiration or a bit of idea or a way to sort of say something. How do I say this comment? Yeah. But it's my problem with AI, and this is it's ignoring the there are if I don't think it's any point in using it for the things we enjoy doing. Like why? You know, you're supposed to use it for the things that we don't enjoy doing. That's the whole point of it. Is let's get rid of those sort of elements to it. But my problem even with that is that when I started in this industry, my first job was to do really boring, mundane things. Like it was like getting release schedules in and putting them into and I had to contact all the PRs, and it's how I got to know the PRs. It's how I got to know what the games they worked on were. And it's how I learned this industry. And when you start getting rid of those, what, you know, we sort of call your dog's body sort of, you know, rubbishy jobs that AI can help, you know, speed up or get rid of. I feel that that's how people learn. That's how people sort of develop, and we're sort of now expecting people to come out of university. It's the kids I'm worried about. We're expecting to sort of come out of university now with fully
fledged. Has anybody thought of the children?
Well, I mean, but it's been like that. Those jobs, you know, if you those early jobs, those things that, you know, it's a little bit systemic or something quite basic. You know, you can now give it to a computer to do it for you. It takes away those roles and it impacts those junior positions. And that's the thing that worries me a little bit about AI. But The truth is, you know, games are getting so, you know, there's that Spider-Man, do you see that Spider-Man 1 costs X, $100 million or something to make, and it made X amount of money. And Miles Morales, which is a much shorter game, costs significantly more to make. And yeah. it generated less money. And then Spider-Man 2 costs double what Miles Morales cost to make. And at the moment, I mean, it probably do better over time, but right now it's making less money again. And you sit there and you go, okay, something needs to be happening. And they're talking about Spider-Man 3 being two games split in two, and in order to make the revenue make up the amount of money these games costing. Sense, the money's going up, and AI can potentially speed up that development and reduce those costs.
Mm. On Andy's side of the ledger, in the world of games media and tech and stuff like that, it's getting harder and harder to find content, certainly like reviews and guides and things that have actually been penned by actual humans. They said this week that every search engine from DuckDuckGo to Google to whatever you're using is just getting worse and worse, just simply because it's very hard to find stuff, like, you know, good stuff behind these massively kind of like machine generated content machines that have been really effectively SEO'd. Have you ever sort of thought about a VGC kind of subscription model, Andy? Because that seems to be where everyone's sort of moving towards.
Well, I don't think they make a terrible amount of money for, you know, kind of outlets like us.
Mm.
I mean, to your point, I mean, you only have to search for anything these days. It feels like it's happened overnight, especially in the last 3-4 months. Google results now are just trash, right?
It's really absolute trash.
You can't find, I have to dig through at least one page to find anything relevant whatsoever. But, you know, like Google, anyone in the media, you know, is well aware that Google changed their algorithms on a multi-year basis, sometimes multi-month basis.
Mm.
So you'd hope that they are very aware of what's the quality of their proposition is being hit hard currently, and then they move to resolve that. It's a tricky balance for everyone, right? I mean, they are the corporations that are investing in AI right now are making all the money. I mean, Microsoft briefly overtook Apple as the biggest company in the world last week, basically because it's the biggest investor in OpenAI.
Mm.
So certainly a company like Google that's got a chokehold on all the media businesses, the online media businesses, you know, they've got these pressures to embrace investing in AI, but also they make money from websites like us, you know, through advertising, putting advertising on our sites, and we get all of our views through most of our views through Google. So it's all, they're like sort of like cannibalizing each other for, it's a very messy situation, right? I mean, what I would say is that it just to put a positive spin on it, because it can feel very doom and gloom in any creative industry at the moment, is that in a world of AI, you know, outlets, publications that are trusted by their readership are going to be more important than ever. That's why it's important for us to do things like this podcast, you know, that is not going to be replaced by a robot one day. I mean, as much as a robot can turn a press release into, you know, into a news story, you know, now or in the very near future, convincingly, they're not going to phone up a lawyer and get a quote and then, you know, speak to some 3D artists and go to GDC and interview this guy. So if anything, it encourages better journalism, I think. That's my positive spin on it anyway. The other side is that we're all doomed.
What about you?
And I should say as well, sorry to interrupt, on the game development side, I think it's important because we've been obviously down on AI, that where, you know, when we're critical of it, it's always like regarding specifically generative AI in art, right? The reason that gets a lot of stick, deservedly so, is because when you're using generative AI for art, you're replacing artists, right? You're replacing their jobs. But at the same time, you're scraping their work. These tools don't work by magic. They're trained on real work. And there's a lawsuit going on right now where a ton of source material leaked for Midjourney, and these artists, like thousands of artists' work are being used, including like Magic the Gathering cards and stuff like that. And that's going on. I think the EU's got an act coming through, and there's something going on in the States, and it's a very, very important battle around that, because these tools are being trained by humans to replace them, right? Yeah. But otherwise, other than that, AI can have a lot of good in game development. I mean, games are already, to Chris's point, they're totally unsustainable AAA games. They cost hundreds and hundreds of millions to make, and it's every 5 years it goes up another 100 million. They create 1,000 people, you know, up to 10 years to make a game. Something's got to give. And if you're using AI to help efficiency, I mean, you look at Microsoft signed a deal to have AI help with bug fixing, bug testing, and localization, and even like NPC dialogue, but not in a creative way. The impression I get is that it's more about, this NPC to tell the player to go towards this objective, you know, just to AI to help the game improve the quality of the game from a player UX experience, right? I mean, Final Fantasy Remake, they used AI to improve the facial animation and the camera angles in cutscenes because they use AI to sense what the tone of the dialogue is, and it would suggest certain camera angles, or it would, like, if it was a tense scene, it might like change the facial animation a bit more on top of the kind of the hand drawn work. So there is a lot of good being done, even though we're focusing on, you know, the negative aspects.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, Chris, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, we would be talking about procedures and algorithms inside computer programs. And they would never be described as artificial intelligence. I mean, these are shortcuts that programmers have used since year dot, really. But now there's a little bit of a kind of panic about artificial intelligence. Like, there was this. Do you sort of feel like that we don't always kind of we've kind of changed what we sort of call just normal programming, and procedural creation of video games that we didn't used to.
I've been writing about tools for years that are designed to, now you can start designing an open world and you put this stuff into the tool and the open world will then create itself. And, you know, the procedurally generated stuff.
Start a Minecraft, procedurally generated,
Yeah, it's that, you know, Worms, right? It's those sort of, like, there are differences in, but there is an element of, like, you know, what we're talking about is a similar idea, which is like, let's use this technology to speed things up, and stuff that's a bit laborious and a bit time consuming we can now use this machine that can sort of do it, and then you go in and then you go and you humanize it and make it different, and then you and it's it's often it's, that's the thing is sometimes it's just getting it done, and then once you've got it done you can build on top of it, and then it's the and then that's the thing. And people are worried about it from a jobs perspective, and I don't think people will lose their jobs, but I think it will probably allow games companies to sort of just keep headcounts to where they are and actually maybe output more and faster. And I think that's the thing that the games industry needs to get to. You know, nobody wants to wait 6 years. You know, was it God of War Ragnarok? They decided they wasn't going to do a trilogy because it would have been too long between the first game and the third game, right? And I'm like, that's mad. Like,
something's got to give. I mean, Sean Layden, the ex-PlayStation US boss, he was quoted like he says it all the time now, but it was big news kind of 4 or 5 years ago where after he left, he was saying something needs to give. We need to make shorter games. Need to be shorter.
I almost did. Sean spoke at one of my events last year and it was like every year that thing he said 4 years ago is just getting more and more proven right. Like it's become we're reaching a point, particularly now that the market's in the situation it's in and game developers having to lay off staff and in the masses they are, it's now starting to come home to roost. Not just that, but it's certainly part of it.
I mean, I'll die on this hill. Obviously, we're all like old men compared to the
procedure generated hill.
yeah. Like, I want shorter games. Yeah. Like, how many games is constantly, right? Like, everyone has got a pile of games, a backlog.
Stops me
games
buying them. It honestly stops it does, me. Yeah. If I hear like, the word open world, I'm not buying it.
Like, sometimes I play a game and this is great. I'm really into this. And you get to the bit where it goes, you enter the huge open field and it goes, now go where you want. No, I just want to be entertained. I want to go and find it. I wanted the artificially inflated fluff that you've put in to put a number on the back of the box.
One of the trends that we're seeing is actually games companies are starting to head towards, not actually like heading in that direction, because we're living in what we call, something called the attention economy, right? Where everyone's competing for people's time. But those live service games, like Naughty Dog just going, you know what? No. We're not going to do that. and it's an example of there just isn't, people don't have that much time. And these games that are 10, 15, 20 hours long that can sit in between those big epic experiences, they're actually proving to be, if you can make those games affordable to make, then those games actually fit quite well in a market where people don't have as much time and just want to play something that's a bit shorter. And, you know, it's, to be fair, this isn't a new trend. I think back in the pre-owned, a set game stopped doing secondhand recently, and it reminded me that back in the day, game developers were encouraged to make longer games with more multiplayer and stuff back then in order to stop people trading in their games.
That's a mad moment, that, isn't it? Like, that made me feel like such a dinosaur, the silence around that moment.
Yeah.
That is such, like, a pivotal, important moment in games, like, you know, these big retailers stopping pre-owned games, because it was only, you know, 10, 12 years ago, that was the biggest issue in video games. We would be on this podcast in 2012 talking about the pre-owned game problem, how, you know, developers were changing the games they made and, you know, making you have to buy season passes and pre-owned passes and, you know, restricting their games just to stop this problem. Well,
that story, so I've described it recently on the Man of the GI podcast. I said that it's a historical moment. But actually, in terms of where the games industry is today, it doesn't mean anything. Like, nobody, it's not really a thing anymore. As soon as people started downloading more than buying physical, that meant there were fewer games being traded in, which meant that market just went do-do-do-do and disappeared. But yeah, we'll see, back in those days, game publishers had about 2 weeks to sell their game. They had to get their game on the shelf. They had 2 weeks. They messed it up. They gave up and moved on to the next game, because then it was on the pre-owned shelves. And I remember if an influencer picked up your game like 2 months later and started playing it, all it really benefited was the game and their secondhand shelves.
Yeah. Right. Interesting. All right, then. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with the latest story regarding closures and downsizing.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We're back with the VGC, a video game podcast at Podcast. I'm Pete Donaldson, joined by Chris and Andy. Guys, speaking of AI, did you see that kind of, I think it's a Chinese company, they put this app together that you can put your artwork, if you're a creator of any great art that you really want protected from AI, they basically hard-code this kind of like imperceptible to the human eye information into a JPEG or a PNG or whatever. Not even to track it, to make a dog look like a cat to a computer and a cat look like a dog to a computer.
Whereas
we just see a dog, the computer sees a cat, and it really messes up any of the Midjourney AI tools. I think they called it like nightshade, like deadly nightshade, which is interesting. Poisoning the AI model, poisoning the AI well. I love that sort of stuff. Like the artists fighting back the only way they know how with a man from China just having a go. Anyway, well, games industry leaders predict that 2024 will be the year of closures, sadly. Game developer Farhan Noor, who's been tracking job cuts dating back to the start of 2023 on the beautifully titled videogamelayoffs.com, estimate that around 10,000 games industry employees were laid off last year. And less than a month into this year, we've got about 3,000 planned job cuts in the pipeline. It's going to be another rough year, guys. And obviously, Chris, this kind of will comprise most of your time. It's been a busy January for writing pieces and investigating pieces about severance pay and P45s and all that.
We haven't had a day this week where we haven't written a layoff story. This year.
Right.
Games industry job is. And it's worth noting that, you know, studios close down all the time and there's downsizing happening all the time. It's just, and some of these stories maybe might have slipped under the radar before, but when you've got things like Riot and Unity cutting 25% of its staff, and Riot knocking 500 people off their things. And that story that you're quoting there is actually one that I did on GamesDotBiz. And it was, I went around a load of games companies hoping for a bit of positivity. I wanted to get in the sense that, is this like when we get to the end of the financial year, will people have made their cuts and we can bounce back?
Yeah.
And the responses I got was no. And that, you know, this might be, some people are more hopeful that 2025 will be better, but this is going to drag on for easily into this year, over this year, and maybe well into next year as well.
Is it just kind of the markets, the city just losing their confidence in the industry, or is it just COVID, just the shadow just looms even larger the further away you get from it?
There are so many, there's so many bits to it. The big thing is obviously there was a ridiculous amount of investment being made during the pandemic, an obscene amount of it. It's excess, right? You know, and the thing is with the market is when one company's doing something, every other company kind of has to do things. So if, let's say, a couple of game developers are raising the salaries of their staff, every game company has to raise the salaries of their staff. And that happens. And you've got things like, if Microsoft's buying a load of studios, Sony has to buy a load of studios. And if Take-Two are trying to expand their sports offering by buying Codemasters, EA is going to swoop in and try and buy Codemasters. And you have this sort of where it just rises the prices. Everyone's pay goes up. Everyone's cost goes up. So you've had that happen. And then the thing is, then the pandemic stopped and then the growth has slowed down. People start making less money. So the growth stopped. All this money's come in. Then you've had things like inflation going up and cost of living going up, which has increased the cost of business. Not just that, but other things have increased, not just wages, but also rents and everything. So the cost of making games have gone up. The amount of money people are spending going up. And what you've got is games companies now having to focus in and cut where there isn't growth and there isn't money being made. Investors aren't investing. That's the big problem. That's why we're going to see closures. There are so many games companies that are unprofitable. And there are so many games companies that have just started up. They're in the middle of making their first game and they need more investment. They've got enough for the first year, enough for the first 2 years. Then they're going to need some more. But the well is dry. And that is why you're going to see this year of closures, because nobody's offering any money at the moment. Growth will come back. This industry's not dead. It's not a cataclysm. It is a crisis. And, you know, the game, people still like playing games. But normally there's something that gets us excited. There's normally a thing on the horizon where investors and people go, oh, that's the thing. It's VR, it's metaverse, it's NFTs, it's whatever it is. And most of it's rubbish. But there's always something that people look to in the future of games. And right now, actually, I was trying to think, I can't think of a thing that's getting people like, oh, that's the thing that's going to change this industry. And all of that stuff is affecting confidence. So there's lack of growth, overspending. That's the big one, overspending, costs going up. And games companies are having to, there's just too many unprofitable companies in this industry.
Andy, is this just when it comes to me loading up Steam or loading up the PS Store or whatever, is there just too much kind of competition for eyes and fingers? And is there just too much trash out there? Is discoverability and curation a real issue for
subscribers? Absolutely. There are too many games. I mean, that's what you're seeing now and probably into, you know, next year as well.
Yeah.
You know, during the pandemic, so too many games got greenlit because we were having a very you know, kind of beautiful summer at the time, the games industry was. And, you know, investors came in, they saw it as a, you know, pandemic-proof industry. You know, everyone expanded, you know, greenlit projects. And I'd probably say there might have been an element of projects being pushed back as well by the pandemic initially to pile on top as well. And that's exactly what you've been seeing for the last 18 months, right? I mean, smaller, medium-sized games have suffered because people you're competing for time, right? It's not just money. I mean, we said it earlier about games being too long. How many games can you realistically play in a year now? Your time that you have.
That's the thing I always have with what we call the attention economy. It's like when you're competing for money, in theory, people's money goes up over time. That's the idea, is that as you get older, you earn more and more money, right? So the idea is you can earn more money and you can buy more games, but you can't get more time in the day. Yeah. And that's the thing that always makes me anxious. So you need to grow the industry. You need to get more gamers in. And that's why Microsoft talk about it all the time. There's not actually that much growth in the UK and Europe and Japan and US. It's India and it's those sort of countries. And those countries, broadly speaking, like playing stuff and watching stuff and listening to stuff that they make. And so that's why you see a lot of games companies trying to find developers in those countries to make games for their audiences. And that's where the actual growth of the industry might be. But yeah, discoverability, that's the other big thing, right? It's just too many, there's too many games. But it depends for some things. Like when I say too many games, I'm always careful that. I think the idea of everybody should be able to make a game, put it out there. I'm obviously talking a very specific type of game, like those sort of AA, those sort of games you get a Devolver or a Team 17 or a Curve or whatever put out, those sort of titles. There's a lot of that going on, and because there was a lot of games commissioned, and we're probably going to see that those will come out in the next 2 years. But it's a great time to be a gamer. Here's the thing: they're still playing. Look at Power World; they're still playing these games and having a whale of a time and spending.
Well, it's great when you've so much choice, right? But it's not useful to people who've spent 100 million on a project and need you to pick their one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a couple of things that I'm excited about. Fortnite, putting games in Fortnite, which is something that that interests me. You know, they've done with the Lego stuff and the Rocket, whatever game that was, Rocket League spin-off they've done. Mm. And then there's also Switch 2's potentially interesting, although Nintendo consoles only tend to help Nintendo. Those are some things.
But I like retreating to Nintendo increasingly these days just because it's much simpler.
The ecosystem's like it's unfussy, isn't it? I suppose you pick it up, you play it, you put it down.
Yeah,
I don't have to read any lore.
No, true. Well, speaking of the Switch 2, 8% of developers in a GDC survey have said that they are going to be working on Nintendo's next console, or they are currently working on Nintendo's next console. For perspective, 66% were toiling away on PC content. Are most just kind of keeping mum on their work so far? Are they just kind of bound to not
contractually, yeah, they come in, even this is anonymous. I mean, from my experience of trying to get developers to say anything, even anonymously, it's a very secretive culture, right? That they are, birthed, forged within. And a lot of them won't even tell you anonymously or off the record anything because they're so attached to that secrecy. So, yeah, there's definitely more. I mean, this comes back from my exclusive last year about the development kits being out there, about the console coming out this year, Nintendo and them kind of speaking to developers at Gamescom about it. Nintendo came out and denied that and said it was inaccurate. So clearly this is suggesting that they are talking poo-poo, as we said at the time. Yeah, I mean, it's the unspoken secret, right? Like the open secret even. Everyone's working on Switch 2 games. It's, you know, we should be hopefully be talking about that very soon.
Is that with the success of stuff like Roblox and stuff? Obviously, it seems to be there's a bit of an appetite for a massive mass market product like Fortnite to become one of those kind of platforms. Could you see us talking less about stuff like Xbox and Switch and in the future, talking about Fortnite as being
100%? Like, this is my opinion. I don't know what Chris thinks, but I remember sitting on a bus to go to Microsoft to see the Xbox One reveal in Redmond. And I remember thinking then, like, this could be one of the last times I get to do this.
Yeah.
Because these closed platforms, their days are numbered, right? You're seeing with Xbox now, what Xbox is doing, which I think is the future. They're taking the platform across devices. I think it's inevitable. I do. Unless Nintendo are going to have to work even harder to create something so unique, you know, this hardware and their IP, they can't get anyone else to, maybe people jump onto that, but even they're starting to allude to getting away from these boom and bust cycles of, you know, building an audience on one console and then doing it again.
Nintendo's a little bit, because Nintendo, I think, might be the last ones to leave the console world, because they're more like a toy company. Yes. I'm not to be belittling that.
But they're 100%. They're not the same. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're sort of like, you know, we create these little things for parents to trust and that kind of stuff. Fortnite would be a closed platform, right? In many respects, it's Epic's Fortnite platform. But obviously this is the joy of Fortnite. You can make a game in Unreal Editor for Fortnite, press publish to Fortnite, and it's on phones, and it's on Switch, and it's on PlayStation, it's on Xbox, and that's the reason why when I was, Epic was talking me through that. Well, actually, that sounds really exciting. But the thing for in terms of like here's the thing, phones, you saw some of the stuff that was, that they put out on iPhone last year, Resident Evil and stuff like that. We are what? How many years away do you think we are before phones and like is starting to match up with the console of today? Yeah. And we're, and that's when that happens and phones are ubiquitous, not just in the West, but everywhere, you know, in places where they don't even have a console industry, they all have smartphones. And that is the thing that it will transform the industry. Obviously, And you know, obviously, on the one hand, I like having my little consoles, my little ecosystems, little communities, elements to it. I do like all that. But then I also hate the absolute toxicity that comes with that as well. So it will be quite a different...
I don't think consoles will go away. It's just going to be probably an option, right? Yeah. I mean, I play predominantly on console. Historically, I was a PC player. But eventually, you just get bored of things not fucking working, right? Like the experience on console, you plug it in, it works, your friends are there. You know, it's easy to get more stuff. It's not like, oh, the frame rate on this is not great, I need to upgrade my RAM. It's, you know, it's just a more comfortable couch experience.
Yeah. Convenience is the thing.
Yeah. And I suppose you would expect the whole kind of peer-to-peer kind of NVIDIA solutions for cloud gaming to have kind of taken control. Because for the reasons we kind of detailed, you know, if we have these platforms that don't exist anymore, we'll need some way to broadcast games. And you imagine cloud services should have been the way to go. But infrastructure is just such a big issue and it's not getting solved anytime soon. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah.
We just don't have the speed.
Yeah. Well,
I very much look forward to seeing Hogwarts Legacy being played on, I don't know, FIFA 16 or something, in the FIFA 16 universe. But Hogwarts Legacy is the first non-COD or Rockstar game to top US sales in 15 years. 2023, last year, of course, for fact fans, marked the first time in 15 years that a Call of Duty or Rockstar game didn't top the annual sales chart in the United States. And you kind of have to read that back, like I just did there, because it is quite a big deal, Chris. This is not happened. It doesn't happen easily. It's quite an achievement, and it's not a game that anybody in maybe my generation is talking about.
Yeah, in the Europe, it was number two, but it's the first time we've not had it. But here's, on the one hand, yeah, it's a big deal, right? It's a different game. It's a Warner Brothers title. Yeah. It's not Call of Duty. But on the other hand, how depressing has this industry become? The biggest games are always either Call of Duty. In the Europe, it's EA FIFA. And then the only game that's been able to challenge those games, unless it's a GTA, is a Harry Potter game. And then you look at slightly lower down the charts, and it's always a Mario, and it's always a Spider-Man. It's always a big IP or a big sequel. The highest charting new IP in the UK charts for 2023 was Starfield at number 37, I think. And it's like that is that was from Bethesda, who are an established. And it's
of a pretty stellar lineup of games previously. Yeah. So that is wild.
So it's and that's kind of the problem with games. Actually, they've got this world where even in the free to play live service, it's still Fortnite, it's still Warzone, it's still the same games. And you know, you don't get that. You get obviously it's always IP related in movies as well. But even movies move from one thing to another over time. TV.
Yeah. Barbie came out of nowhere, for example. Yeah. I know it's a massive brand, but probably a bad example. But
No, but I know what you're saying. So Barbie's new. Barbie's, yes, it's an IP and it's, you know, it's not new in the
film space.
Yeah, Oppenheimer, you know, these sort of things. You get these things that come out. And it's been Marvel for a while, but not entirely. And then you've got things like, and then suddenly they bring Jurassic World back and it gets in there and it's, you know, yeah, sure. It's not exactly creative originality, but it's still
nice to have.
It's different. It's nice different. It's not just Call of Duty every year. And in TV, it's even more different, right? They often go, right, it's now got Game of Thrones and now it's Stranger Things. And then they change quite a bit. And it's we don't get that. We're not having that in games at the moment. And I think that's a problem.
Mm. Is this just what we experienced in the film industry in like the 80s, like the same franchises, your Ghostbusters? But I guess they were new IPs back then, but I suppose the second and third films absolutely topped the charts as well. Well, look, thank heavens for games like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth. Jordan called it a can't-miss RPG. Will you be missing it, guys? You're both men with children. You're going to be playing the 150 hours of Like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth. I love the Yakuza series, but good God, they just bleat on for ages.
I feel like I'm about nine games behind now.
we're both massive Japanophiles, aren't we, Andy? And we love the culture, but we just love walking into a combini and just dicking about and looking at the new products and
smashing
the bits
it up.
And bobs. Just smashing it up with a big sign you found outside or a bicycle. But it speaks to our love of, I don't know about you, but certainly, you know, my love of Shenmue back in the day. But I have only played two of them through to completion. I do look at stuff like this, especially as it's turn-based as well. I sort of go, right, what?
If they had like a free, you know, a 5 to 6 hour mode even.
Give me just
I'd
all
the
side quests.
All of them.
Give me all the silly games from all of the series. Just put it all in. I'll run a snack bar for a bit. I'll photograph men in their speedos from a moving car. I'll do all that stuff. Just don't give me any of the story because I'm not interested. I think it's fair to say. Yeah. Also on the site at the moment, do check it out if you can. We've got a review of Tekken 8, a sensational sequel, even if it is causing some issues for people with colour blindness or perhaps people with further issues in that space. Chris gave it a decent score, Andy.
Is it 5 out of 5, I think?
I think it's 5 out of 5.
Two,
that is
two,
about
five
as decent
fives,
as
yeah.
it gets.
So it's off to a good start, isn't it? There's at least 3 must-play games this month. If you include Prince of Persia as well, which I'm playing, which is brilliant. So yeah, you know, good stuff. More games to add to our pile.
That we'll never get to. Well, let's ship off, shall we? Do leave a review for the podcast wherever you may be experiencing this podcast right now. Screenshot it, send it to @JordanMidler on Twitter, and Jordan will randomly give someone a code. That man just receives a lot of codes, so he'll be able to chuck one your way if he likes your review. Send your questions, comments and concerns to podcast@videogameschronicle.com. Thank you very much for joining me this morning, Chris and Andy. What have you got on for the rest of the day? What have you got on for the rest of the week? What have you got on for the rest of the year? Let's start with you, Chris.
Oh, week.
Let's go through your calendar.
I've got a meeting at 3. I've actually got a couple of days off coming up. I've only just finished Tears of the Kingdom. It took me 9 months, and now I'm going to be doing Prince of Persia. So I'm sort of looking for a couple of days off to do that. And then just sitting at home playing Prince of Persia.
Fantastic.
And then I guess I'm looking forward to this year. I'm looking forward to going to GDC this year. I didn't go last year, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to Summer Games Fest and we're all booking our things. I'm looking forward to getting out there and speaking to people and hearing about this industry. And I know it's tough out there, and that's why people like me, games industry shoppers, for instance, is needed, and that's why we do our thing. So it's I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, got a fun year ahead. Hopefully.
Do you feel sometimes like you're the harbinger of kind of, you know, you're kind of at the deliverer of bad news because all of the business news in the industry, no one's hiring and everyone's firing?
Yeah, well, we do feel that way, but then it's our job to sort of then try and go, okay, how do we get through this? And then look, the job, we call it B2B, is literally getting this company to talk to this company, this person to talk to this person, just getting them talking to each other. And I just feel like, we said this from the beginning of the year to my team. We're like, we've got to do this. We've got to be there to help this industry get through this next 12 months at least.
Chris is like the Spider-Man, but instead of the New York streets, he's just sitting in games.
Yeah, out loud. When he swings into view, everyone runs.
Andy, what's coming up on the site?
I'm playing a game I can't talk about at the moment.
Oh,
Jordan's at Respawn doing something I don't know. So
yeah. Respawn are keeping their cards quite close to their chest. Is the Star Wars FPS anywhere closer to getting kind of revealed? Or
I have no idea.
We'll find out.
there's a Tekken party tonight. Might look up at that. Yeah.
Tekken a few event. Drink or two.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, they might. Yeah, make me play Tekken.
Yeah.
Which is you know, accessible enough for people like me, right? What else is going on? Nothing really. It's January. It's dark.
It's January. It's
no one's
quiet.
Got any
it's
money.
Dark. Just keep warm. Don't do dry January. Just
play some good
play
video
some
games
for crying out loud. Well, thank you very much for listening to the podcast, everyone. You can follow myself @PeteDonaldson on X. Chris _ Dring and Andy _VGC. We'd like to thank the fantastic Grant Kirkhope for the VGC podcast theme song. Say goodbye, Andy.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Chris.
See you later.
And we'll see you next week at the same time.
Bye!
VGC, a video games podcast, is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.